Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, as you've been hearing in the bulletins, the American Army veteran suspected of driving a pickup truck into people celebrating the New Year in New Orleans was inspired by the Islamic State terrorist organization, according to the US President Joe Biden. And officials are investigating whether the chief suspect, named as Shamsuddin Jabbar, was operating in concert with others. Well, for more on this, we're going to have some analysis in just a moment. But first, let's take a listen to this clip from J.P. Morrell, Vice President of the New Orleans City Council. He was speaking to the BBC World Service a little earlier on and gave the very latest information on what the FBI have been uncovering.
Well, we know the attacker rented a vehicle from Turo, which is like a Airbnb of cars kind of app where you rent cars peer-to-peer. It's not heavily regulated. We know that the attacker used an Airbnb, not a traditional hotel, which, as you know, with Airbnb and Turo, these are really unregulated kind of mechanisms for people getting around and getting lodging. That's what we know now. We know that there was potentially some IED equipment inside of the Airbnb. We also know that, as you stated, that there are potentially other individuals involved, and there were other IEDs identified near where the attack happened, but were not placed by the attacker, which is why at this point, from our perspective and from the federal government's perspective, it is being classified and looked at as a multi-prong, multi-person terrorist attack.
And that was J.P. Morrell, Vice President of the New Orleans City Council. We're joined now on the line by Peter Neumann, Professor of Security Studies at King's College in London. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Colm.
You're a terrorism, specifically an expert on radicalization, and you've looked also at what the American security response has been to terrorism under the previous Trump administration. We might get into some of that in a moment. But how concerned will the U.S. authorities be about the apparent radicalization of a U.S. Army veteran and the reports that he may not have been operating alone?
It's very concerning. Partly because of everything you said, but partly also because the U.S. government, as well as European governments, actually for a very long time thought that this threat from ISIS had passed, that this was declining, and that with the destruction of the so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria end of last decade, this was basically over. And this attack now seems to signify that it's not completely over yet, that if anything, it is coming back. It's in fact been the biggest attack of ISIS in the West since 2016, the most deadly attack with 15 people dead. And so this seems to be a harbinger, if anything, of perhaps even more to come.
Now, I mean, we know little enough at this stage of things, but this person is a U.S. Army veteran. He is a convert to Islam. Would it fit the profile of somebody perhaps who has self-radicalized online as opposed to somebody who has been, say, charged with a mission from abroad?
That seems to be the strongest hypothesis at this moment. And in fact, in 2008, a long time ago, there was another serving U.S. military officer who radicalized and then carried out a devastating attack. So this is not unprecedented. It's a strong hypothesis because for the time being, there don't seem to be any collaborator. And it's also a strong hypothesis because U.S. President Biden actually spoke of an inspired attack. And that's typically used for attacks where there is no firm connection, as far as we know, to an IS organized structure or network. This seems, for the time being, to be someone who perhaps has radicalized on the internet and then gone off to do something on his own.
They are investigating, the authorities still investigating the possibility of other people operating in concert with the apparent perpetrator here. But in terms of how radicalization works to this level and what outside help there might be in that, in your studies, what kind of patterns have you found?
So they are changing patterns, but typically what happens is that it begins with a personal crisis. And from what we know from the biography of the suspect here, it seems to have been a crisis in terms of finance, a crisis in terms of his relationship with his wife. Everything has gone down. Then he suddenly started getting interested in radical material. And this is the big change, because 10 years ago, we would have said, most experts would have said, that online radicalization is not really possible. Yes, the internet plays a big role, but typically you need other things to happen as well. But now we're seeing more and more cases where people are becoming radicalized almost entirely through social media, through online material. And it wouldn't surprise me if that had been the case here as well. So yes, there are patterns, but the patterns are also changing.
Shamsuddin Jabbar was somebody who was, as I say, had some level of military training. I suppose another phenomenon you would have seen looking at attacks over time would have been people who are relative novices getting instructions in real time via telecommunications during attacks. Would you say that's less likely in this case, given his background?
Well, so we'll have to see. And what I expect today is some kind of message from ISIS. If this was really ISIS, they typically do come out with a message. And that message then also indicates whether there was a relationship between the organization and the perpetrator. Typically indicated, for example, if they also publish a video that he may have sent them before. We will see. We will have to wait and see. But I agree, all of this is possible. It's possible that he was purely inspired, did this by himself, because ISIS actually actively encourages that. It tells its followers, you can do stuff on your own, and we will then claim it afterwards. But it can also be that there was a relationship, that there was some communication between the organization and the perpetrator. We don't know this at this point. Both is possible.
From the point of view of ISIS, as you say, they may treat this as a propaganda opportunity. They had been on the wane in recent years, although with some increase in activities more recently, particularly in eastern Syria. Is it something that the organization will feel it needs to capitalize on, in your analysis?
100%. I've been saying this for a while. I think the turning point for ISIS, if you want, it was October 7, 2023, the terrorist offensive by Hamas, and of course the ensuing conflict in the Middle East, the Israeli military campaign, which has led to a massive mobilization of Islamism and jihadism online. And ISIS, even though it was not participating in the attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, has been trying to capitalize on this. It's been telling people, you have to fight yourself. Look what is happening in the Middle East. Our brothers and sisters are being killed. You have to defend yourself. You have to defend the Muslims. And you don't do that by just signing a petition or going on a demonstration. You do that by killing people yourself. And that's how ISIS has been propagandizing for the past year and a half. And we're seeing an increasing number of cases where that seems to have resonated with people, and people have started doing stuff, especially in Europe, but also, it seems, in the United States.
Now, back, I think, about 5 years ago, in your book, Bluster, you looked at Donald Trump's counterterrorism response. If the past is to be a predictor of future action, what kind of a response do you think the Trump administration might mount, or would it be more reluctant then to withdraw for its the American presence in Syria that's combating ISIS at the moment? What do you think?
Well, I think what the Trump administration sees this as is very much as a sort of American-centric incident. And of course, the response will be very vicious. Donald Trump will be, as he has done in 2016-17, say very ugly things towards Muslims. Even though this was someone who was born and raised in the U.S., as far as we know, he will say this was about the border and we have to shut down the border. We have to maybe bring in another Muslim ban, as he said in 2016-17. So I think he will be very hard on this. And it will play with his audience and with his voters. Whether that has any implications as to the presence of U.S. in Syria, I don't know. I don't think that features heavily in his mind. The presence of U.S. in Syria is very small to begin with. It's just 1,000 or a couple of thousand U.S. troops, and they're actually very important. It would be very stupid and counterproductive to withdraw them, because that would actually make ISIS even more of a threat.
All right. And in Europe, do you think governments will be paying attention to this? Obviously, we had the recent attack in Magdeburg, although not an ISIS-inspired attack. In fact, quite the contrary. But obviously, Europe has seen terror attacks by people who were self-radicalized and operating largely alone. Is this something that European governments will be paying attention to if it is seen as the beginning of a new wave of ISIS attacks?
Absolutely. And I think we've seen this especially in Europe. I've done the statistics on this, and basically compared to 2022, we have a fourfold increase in the volume of jihadist activity, jihadist attacks and attempted attacks, especially in Europe. Even in Ireland, an attempted attack. And so I do think that this is something that European governments will look at as very much part of a pattern of increasing activity. And that's why I argue, let's make this a priority. Let's fight this before the really big attacks happen again, like in 2015-16 in Brussels and Paris. Let's be ahead of the curve for once.
Okay, Peter Neumann, Professor of Security Studies at King's College in London. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, we're also joined on the line by Patrick Bury, Senior Associate Professor in Warfare and Counterterrorism at the University of Bath. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Colin.
Since the highly coordinated Paris attacks in 2015, we've seen a kind of a move to these cruder forms of attacks. So what should authorities be looking out for if this is indeed one such attack?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, jihadists in particular, but also the far right, but jihadists in particular over the last 20 years have been really keen to target transport infrastructure and events. And we've seen that multiple times, you know. And so one of the first things, obviously, there's numerous different strands about how you try to disrupt a crude attack or a sophisticated one. They're slightly different, obviously, but the cruder ones are a recognition that they've moved to these crude tactics because of counterterrorism pressure. Basically, it's harder to do the big sophisticated attacks because counterterrorism and intelligence is better in the West. Yeah, so you move to these crude attacks, of course. And one of the main things with the crude attack and preventing them is called protective security. So you've got to have designed into the architecture, especially around mass events like Bourbon Street, you've got to have the protective security piece in place. And it looks like this and the Magdeburg attack, there's been like an unfortunate lapse and in some ways an unforgivable unfortunate lapse, in that the barriers at Bourbon Street look to have been being repaired before the Super Bowl and have been basically removed. And it's beyond me that nothing has been put in there in terms of concrete barriers, temporary, etc., to stop that. And in Magdeburg, different kind of attack, of course, but the attacker drove up the only unbarricaded street because it was left open for emergency vehicles that were waiting in case there was an incident to egress. So you're talking about kind of major failures in protective security. That's the first thing I would say. And the second one, as Peter mentioned there, you know, whether this is going to be inspired, so link, you know, basically consuming content, potentially, you know, a light link to the IS organization, or it's something more sophisticated and more heavily networked, as Peter said. And what was interesting there in terms of Morrell's talk about what had happened was the fact that he mentioned multiple IEDs, which to my mind may suggest there's more people involved, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, well, as you were pointing out there, you know, the barriers, the bollards in Bourbon Street were under repair, but the person who's the chief suspect in this, who was shot in the exchange with police, Shamsuddin Jabbar, he's from Texas. So would the intelligence services be looking out for associates who may have provided him with the intelligence that there was an opportunity here?
Well, apparently the fact that the Bourbon Street barriers were under repair was online. So, like, that's beggar's belief, some of this stuff, you know. Obviously, they wanted to inform residents, but, you know, it goes to show you what the threat picture is at the moment. And if there is a gap, these guys, whether it's happened in France in 2015, Nice in 2016, Brussels, these guys are mapping the gaps. It's their job. They're looking for the gaps. And you've got to close those gaps or people die. And that's basically what it is. And of course, it's a game of adapt or die, essentially. You know, it's measure, countermeasure, measure, countermeasure. That's what the evolution we're going through. But yeah, and it also has implications, not to scare anyone in Ireland, but it has implications for Ireland because the protective security piece in some places, I would say, could be better. So, yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate, but I looked at Magdeburg and, you know, they're very cheap, highly mobile and effective anti-vehicle barriers can be put in around these places. It's not rocket science to give them much more protection. Granted, in the US, like, you've got larger vehicles and trucks, it needs a more expensive option. But it's a lapse, essentially, it's caused it.
I heard JP Morrell elsewhere in that interview he did with the BBC World Service this morning saying that the Bourbon Street area and events like the Sugar Bowl had been identified as quote unquote soft targets. It calls into question even more, as you say, why maybe a backup plan wasn't in place while these bollards were being repaired.
Absolutely. You know, you can't take out protective security measure and then think everything will be okay. And that's fallen on somebody. You know, maybe it's a costing thing. As often these things happen, it's about budgets. Maybe not. I don't have the granular detail. I'm sure it'll come out in the investigation afterwards. I think the wider thing might be the failure to realize, as Peter said, that the October the 7th attack has basically put more energy in the terrorist system. And there's usually a lag of around 2 years or so between a major event or a radicalizing event in someone's life and then their ability or their actual commitment to commit an action. So, you know, we are probably entering a phase where there's more of this now and more energy in that system, unfortunately. But that means that our protective security piece and our intel, our prevent, our pursue, all that needs to start to gear up to.
All right. We seem to have lost Patrick there. We have Mike Harrigan, who's retired chief of the FBI's firearms training unit, on the line. Mike, in your analysis of what we know so far, the local authorities in tandem with the FBI are saying that this doesn't look like a lone wolf attack given the presence of other IEDs. What kind of work will the FBI be doing in order to try and work from the clues they have so far to try and identify who might still be in the area or involved in a terror cell, if that is what it is?
Well, thanks for having me. Good morning. And I think from here, the FBI has got some good evidence. Obviously, they got the vehicle and they know who the attacker is. So I think with the video they have of other IEDs being placed, that gives them a lot of good information to work off of. So they'll be working hard to try to identify those individuals. And I think what they'll be doing is the individual who's deceased, who was the attacker, they'll be looking at all his electronic communications. They'll be looking at friends and associates and family members and public information that comes in to try to retrace his steps over the last several days, weeks, months, even further back than that, to try to figure out who his associates were in the hope that these other individuals, you know, obviously would have been connected with him somehow, and whether they were working together or maybe through another person who was the mastermind of the event. Hard to say right now, but it's all hands on deck here, so to speak, and they're looking at just about everything they can look at around the clock, trying to track this down and make sure this isn't a larger conspiracy in which there could have been other targets out there. So it's going to be a very busy time for the FBI, but I think there's going to be this will be resolved fairly quickly, given the information they have. I don't see this going on too long. So if there is a larger conspiracy, I'm sure there'll be arrests in the coming days.
Would you imagine that there will be also an international dimension to this FBI talking to perhaps colleagues in the CIA to see if there's any relevant intelligence from abroad to see if this was coordinated with any outside actor?
Absolutely. That's a key point here, is this individual was clearly radicalized at some point. And the question is, that radicalization, was it domestic-based? Was it a group of like-minded individuals here in the United States? Or was it an internationally influenced situation? So normally in these situations, you're going to have close cooperation between the intelligence agencies gathering overseas intelligence, the FBI and its domestic partners maximizing domestic intelligence, what they know and what they can get, putting it all together to find out if this is something that reaches across international borders. And given the history of ISIS here, if the flag found in that individual's vehicle turns out that he had an actual connection with ISIS or the remnants of ISIS leadership, that would be deeply problematic and something that would be hard to deal with, but would be something that I think they can address. But yeah, the information here, it's going to be a fast news day today as things start pouring in on day two, and I think you're going to see a lot of good information coming out.
All right. What finally then, and briefly, will the intelligence services be able to tell from the construction and I suppose expertise used in the IEDs that were made? From your point of view as a retired chief of the FBI's firearms training unit, what kind of forensic intelligence could be gleaned from how the IEDs were made?
Well, basically what happens whenever there's explosive devices are recovered, they go to the FBI's specialized unit that looks at explosives. And they look for signature on these things, as their bomb makers have a certain method of constructing explosives. Now, they can shift that method over time, but there's certain components they buy, there's certain ways they make the explosive and the triggering device. And those can be linked from one explosive at one scene to an explosive at another scene if the person making it was the same one, if it was the same person that made it at two disparate locations. So that's going to be key right there, because from those bomb components, you can then track back where they were obtained. They had to be some commercial source for some of the components in there, if not all of them, and they're going to be looking hard to track that back to find out where they were purchased and by who, and then also, as they look forward to other potential issues that may develop over the several days, if other devices are recovered, especially during search warrants, other places in the country, they'll be able to hopefully tie those devices together by how they were manufactured and the components used. And that helps them build a case and also become comfortable that they have the right person when they have the devices that are similar. Because if you look at in the news, too, there was an individual in Virginia today or a few days ago that was arrested with a large cache of explosives. Now, it looks like that's totally unrelated. It was a whole other situation, but when they look at those two explosive cases, they can quickly rule out that clearly this guy had no connection, completely different type of construction okay. And components. But that's what they use. That's how they look at these things.
Okay, many thanks, Mike. Mike Harrigan there, retired chief of the FBI Firearms Training Unit. And before that, we heard from Peter Neumann, professor of security studies in King's College in London, and from Patrick Bury, senior associate professor in warfare and counterterrorism at the University of Bath. Coming up in a minute, we'll be hearing the latest on that rapid surge in flu cases.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.